My name is Fred Niedner, from Valparaiso, Indiana. Happy to be here once again to talk about the third in our series called Handling the Bible's Hatreds. And today's subtitle is Foreign Women. And as we'll see, there are lots of stories about how foreign women and their relationship to the Israelite people and to the New Testament folk are important. The theme is part of Holden's summer theme of A Whole New World, in commemoration of Columbus coming to this continent and people describing this as a new world. And the theme here this summer is to try to think about how this world might be made new in some different sorts of ways, including finding ways that people cut off from each other due to various forms of enmities, hatreds, and other polarizations can be reconciled. I searched long and hard for some foreign women humor. There will be some toward the end that fits in better there, so I will leave it there. I did recall a bit of instruction I once received from a close friend of mine who is a Jewish rabbi, who taught part-time in my department, theology department of Valparaiso University some years ago. Some of you may be hearing of him soon because there's so many Minnesotans here. His name is Rabbi Joseph Edelheit, a reform rabbi who just in the next 2 weeks will be taking over the pulpit of the largest reform synagogue in Minneapolis. Anyway, he told me how to distinguish the level of severity of the various ois that Jewish people employ. Oy vey, ois mir, and oy gewalt. You know, he said there are very clear differences between those and the ways that you should use them. For example, if you have a boy child and the child gets to the age where you want to buy them let's say a ball glove and a bat, and the first time he takes them off to play with them and comes home without either one of them and has no clue as to where they've ended up, you say, oy vey. And then when that same child grows to be bar mitzvah age and you buy him a brand new suit for his bar mitzvah, and as soon as the ceremonies are over, he and his friends go out and he manages during playfulness to rip the pants to shreds on a barbed wire fence, you say, oy, Samir. But when the boy goes away to college and after some time comes home with his intended to introduce her to the family and she turns out to be blonde, blue-eyed, and Presbyterian, that's when you say, oy, gewalt. Well, women were what we nowadays call marginalized in the ancient period of the biblical world, whether they were insiders or outsiders, but a foreign woman was doubly an outsider. I presume that most of you are aware by now that women in that era were property. All women were the property of some man, either their father or their husband, and should their father or husband die, they became the property by very carefully laid out laws of men who are next of kin in some way or another. A foreign woman was not only a piece of property like anyone else, but lived with all the stigmas that went with a society which had both mores and laws that placed them under even more restrictions. There are lots of stories of foreign women and troubles that came up over the inclusion of foreign women in the Old Testament, going all the way back, I suppose, to Jacob and Esau and their parents. One of the reasons why Jacob is dispatched to go back to the land of our ancestors to find a wife instead of picking one from around here in the new land where we live is because Esau did take a couple of wives from the local population, and they drove Rebekah nuts, and she wouldn't have any more Canaanite wives running around in her extended household. Samson took a shining to one of the daughters of the Philistines and insisted that his parents get her for him for wife. And they said, couldn't you fall in love with somebody from our own people? You gotta have a Philistine. And he said, no, I want her. Get her for me. And so they did, and what happened was terrible, ending up with all sorts of murder, and including the murder of her. So big time trouble over marrying foreign women. It really becomes a serious matter after the time known as the exile, when the Babylonians had scattered the population of the people of Israel all over the ancient Near Eastern world, and Jews now lived in little pockets all over the place. And when they were allowed to return from exile to the homeland under Persian rule, and to attempt to reestablish their culture and their traditions, which the Persians wanted them to do, one of the things that the leader, Ezra, did was to make an edict which now forbade having non-Israelite wives. No foreign wives were to be tolerated, and any that were already any wives already in the community that were foreigners had to be gotten rid of. And so there's this terribly sad scene at the end of the book of Ezra in which this long, long, long list of just the Levite families involved, of women and the children who were divorced and sent away, appears. You know, and you can just imagine what kind of a day that must have been for all those people, the day that they had this mass divorce of all these women and packed them all off along with the children to go back and try to find their original families and homelands again. And Ezra and Nehemiah were pretty heartless about it. At the end of the book of Ezra and the book of Nehemiah, you find very strong, even ugly language and bragging on the part of Nehemiah at the end of the book of Nehemiah that he found a couple of people who still had their foreign wives and didn't want to get rid of them because they wanted to keep them. And so he beat them up, physically assaulted them, and pulled the hair out of their beards. And then says to God, remember me, O God, for the good things that I have done in treating these men this way. Well, why would you have that kind of a policy? To put the best construction on it, the rationale seemed to be that scattered around now a tiny population of Jewish people feared being assimilated by intermarriage into the neighboring cultures and simply disappearing as a distinct people. And Ezra believed that if that happened, that might be the end of God's dream of bringing blessing to all the families of the earth through the seed of Abraham and Sarah. What if we just let ourselves evaporate as a people? What will come of God's dream? The dream God had, which involved his giving us the Torah. And so they tried to remain in that way a distinct people. It was not an uncontested policy. The book of Ruth was written during the days in the aftermath of Ezra's reform. It's set in the period of the judges back before monarchical days, but it was written during the reform of Ezra and appears in the very last section of the Hebrew canon known as the Writings. It's a story of a foreign woman, a Moabitess, not just any foreign woman, one of those scum, you know, whose ancestors come from drunken incest, Lot's daughters, and that whole story. That's one of those women. And she comes back home with her mother-in-law and gets into the family. And it's a very wonderfully rich story with lots of symbolism, but the story means to say, look, Ezra, the house of Israel won't fall even if you bring into it women like Ruth, a friend of the Jews, a true friend. The name Ruth means friendship. And she comes into the house of Boaz. Boaz is a sentence. It means built in strength. And it was the word that was hyphenated, or whatever you call it, and put on either side of the doorposts of a home in ancient Israel. Bo on one pillar, Oz on the other. Built in strength. That's like the building code. This will stand. You know, you can come in here, it's safe. So Ruth, the friend of Israel, comes into the home. It's not going to fall. So Ezra, you know that just because a woman is a foreigner doesn't mean it's going to damage Israel. So there were lots of controversies over including foreigners into the families. In the New Testament, there is a wonderful story of a foreign woman that is our focus for today, and I want to have a reading of it here. It's John 4. Would you all please turn to John 4? And I'd like to read this as follows. I want a volunteer to be the narrator, another to be the woman, and another to be Jesus. And the narrator will read the opening paragraph and any other full sentences that appear, like verse, you can see them. We're not going to have anybody read the parts that say, and he said, and she said, and so forth. We'll skip that and just have the dialogue. And the narrator will read all the parts that aren't dialogue except for the he said, she said lines. So is there a volunteer to be a narrator? Anybody read those parts? Okay. Can we have a woman to read the woman's parts? All right. And someone to read the parts of Jesus. Probably a male, but it wouldn't have to be. Anybody volunteer to be Jesus?
You can volunteer him.
Would you read the Jesus parts? Okay. All right, would the narrator crank us up, please?
And how far are we going to go?
Well, we'll go as far as verse 45.
Pharisees heard that Jesus was gaining and baptizing more disciples than John, although in fact it was not Jesus who baptized, but his disciples. When the Lord learned of this, he left Judea and went back once more to Galilee. Now he had to go through Samaria, so he came to a town in Samaria called Sychar, near the plot of ground Jacob had given his son Joseph. Jacob's well was there, and Jesus, tired as he was from the journey, sat down by the well. It was about the sixth hour, when a Samaritan woman came to draw water.
Give me a drink.
Oh, the narrator can read the verse 8.
Okay. His disciples had gone into the town to buy food.
How is it that you, a Jew, ask of me, as a woman of Samaria?
For Jews do not associate with Samaritans.
If you knew the gift of God and who it is that is saying to you, give me a drink, you would have asked him, and he would have given you living water.
Sir, you have nothing to draw with, and the well is deep. Where do you get that living water? Are you greater than our father Jacob, who gave us the well and drank from it himself and his sons and his cattle?
Everyone who drinks of this water will thirst again. But whoever drinks of the water that I shall give him will never thirst. The water that I shall give him will become in him a spring of water welling up to eternal life.
Sir, give me this water that I may not thirst nor come here to draw.
Go, call your husband, and come here.
I have no husband.
You are right in saying I have no husband, for you have had five husbands, and he whom you now have is not your husband. This you said truly.
Sir, I perceive that you are a prophet. Our fathers worshipped on this mountain, and you say that in Jerusalem is the place where men ought to worship.
Woman, believe me, the hour is coming when neither on this mountain nor in Jerusalem will you worship the Father. You worship what you do not know. We worship what we know, for salvation is from the Jews. But the hour is coming, and now is, when the true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and truth, for such the Father seeks to worship him. God is spirit, and those who worship him must worship in spirit and truth.
I know that Messiah is coming, he who is called Christ. When he comes, he will show us all things.
I who speak to you, am he.
Just then his disciples returned and were surprised to find him talking with a woman. But no one asked, what do you want, or why are you talking with her? Then, leaving her water jar, the woman went back to the town and said to the people,
come, see a man who told me all that I ever did. Can this be the Christ?
They came out of the town and made their way toward him. Meanwhile, his disciples urged him, Rabbi, eat something.
I have food to eat of which you do not know.
Then his disciples said to each other, could someone have brought him food?
My food is to do the will of him who sent me and to accomplish his work. Do you not say, there are yet 4 months, then comes the harvest? I tell you, lift up your eyes and see how the fields are already white for harvest. He who reaps receives wages and gathers fruit for eternal life, so that the sower and the reaper may rejoice together. For here the saying holds true. One sows and another reaps. I sent you to reap that for which you did not labor. Others have labored, and you have entered into their labor.
Many of the Samaritans from the town believed in him because of the woman's testimony.
He told me all that I ever did.
So when the Samaritans came to him, they urged him to stay with them, and he stayed 2 days. And because of his words, many more became believers. They said to the woman, We no longer believe just because of what you said. Now we have heard for ourselves, and we know that this man really is the Savior of the world. After the 2 days, he left for Galilee. Now Jesus himself had pointed out that a prophet has no honor in his own country. When he arrived in Galilee, the Galileans welcomed him. They had seen all that he had done in Jerusalem at the Passover feast, for they also had been there.
Okay, thank you. Well, do you see any clues in that story as to the status of this woman in the eyes of anybody? Is her social position indicated in any way?
The disciples were so surprised that he would speak to her.
All right, they express astonishment. In fact, it seems that they are astonished that Jesus is talking to any woman, at least that's the way the NRSV suggests that they come and they are astonished that he is speaking to a woman. So.
It seems that everything about her personal history puts her even lower on the status pole.
Yeah. What do you make of the conversation about her husbands? Is Jesus putting her down? Or what does he intend to be communicating by calling attention to all these marriages?
Well, I wondered if her husbands were dead or whether they just divorced.
Yeah, we don't know, do we? What we do know.
Well, I was impressed that he was accepted a woman who had a live-in partner. this is one of the things we talk about today, though.
Yeah. Yeah.
He doesn't seem judgmental. It seems that he's just stating the situation as it exists.
Yeah. Yeah. He doesn't comment on it except to point out this is the case. It would have been. To a genuinely pious, observant Jew of the time, somewhat scandalous, because the Torah allows you three marriages. And if you have been married three times and either divorced or widowed, then you are supposed to find a way to live alone. And so she's two marriages and a partner beyond what the Torah allowed, so at least Torah would have frowned upon what she's done. Although Jesus doesn't say, you know what the Torah says. So, but the reader might understand that here is at least calling attention to something untoward in her behavior. Any other clues as to assumptions that the story or anybody in the story makes about her position relative to others?
Her own comments.
Right,
she
says
it. Yeah.
So she calls attention to the obvious Jew-Samaritan rift. How is it that you, a Jew, ask of me, a Samaritan, a drink?
She doesn't seem to be an outcast in her community, though, because she goes and tells, and they come with her to see who
right.
She had met.
Yeah, she's a credible person back home, definitely.
I wondered if that isn't a commentary on the Samaritans, on their particular morality. If indeed living with having five, all of these husbands, that she wouldn't be acceptable in the Jewish community, but yet she was in the Samaritan community. Their morals must be lower.
Well, that's what the Jewish people thought for sure. Was it? Well, Samaritan, you know, what the heck, you know? So what if they marry, you know, 80 times? There really were some vicious things said among the Jews about the Samaritans, you know, and especially about the women. You know, not in the biblical material, but in other rabbinic literature and so forth, the Samaritan women are constantly made fun of, and the even the female babies were said to be already menstrually unclean in their cradles. You know, that's the way they spoke of them. So Samaritan women were really put down rather viciously by. You know, in Jewish society at the time. And the commentaries, too, try to get in on this. If you read some commentaries on John, almost all of them pick up the fact that this woman is appearing at the well at noon. You know, and polite, modest women come to the well very early in the morning or just about dusk. Women don't go to the well at midday. I read one commentary once that got so rude as to put it this way. Any woman who came to a well, no, it was, what a woman who came to the well at noon hoped to find there, you couldn't take home in a bucket. I mean, really. I always wonder about commentaries like that, you know, how much they're projecting.
eyewitness account.
Because I can't think of any other reason Mary Magdalene got made into a prostitute except by projection. Because it doesn't say that anywhere. Anyway, there are lots of ways to read this, either read into the story or to read right in the story, that this woman is a bit on the edges of things. Do you feel like she, in this story as we heard it this morning, is she brought closer in, or does she still remain an outsider? Does her position or status change at all by the end of the story?
Well, acceptance, his acceptance of her changes her status.
Okay.
Well, and the other people confirm that they believe the first by her testimony, but then they confirm the evidence themselves. So she's
okay.
More credible, yeah.
If anything, she becomes a credible witness whose testimony is confirmed. And that, if you understand the context of first century, is something in and of itself worth noting, because a woman was not even allowed to testify in a legal proceeding because women were not considered credible witnesses. They couldn't testify in a legal proceeding, which caused the early church all sorts of problems, since the people at the empty tomb were women, you know, and they go, oh man, you know, these are our witnesses.
Well, women weren't even credible witnesses in the 19th century.
Yeah, that's right.
They were just as uptight about women then.
Yeah, this did not end long ago.
In the church.
Yeah.
Even though she gained something, I think when you read this, of all the people who speak to Jesus in the Bible, she's got to be one of the most assertive, the most, you have the feel of her personality.
Yeah.
Stronger than almost anybody else that Jesus talks to outside of the disciples. And mm-hmm. She's in itself, I think, sort of amazing, since she's going to be a marginalized person.
Yeah. You know?
She's starting to believe, and she says, give me this little water. How can I have this?
Mm-hmm. She speaks with imperatives. Uh-huh. Yeah. Very much like the Syrophoenician woman in Matthew, who won't be put off, even though Jesus says, when she asks for help, look, I'm here for the Israelites, I don't give dogs things. And she says, well, dogs take crumbs. Yeah. And he is startled by that into saying, oh, woman, great is your faith. You know? So this is a similarly assertive person, that's true. Well, I'd like to show you that by the end of this story, she has a status that we haven't yet mentioned, that you might not have noted yet, because you don't realize that your eyes are trained to recognize that status, though they are trained, and I'll have to show you that they are. Because you know a whole bunch of stories, if you know the Bible very well at all, that put her into a really wonderfully new category because of this story. Let's flip back, please, to Genesis chapter 24. We found with Judas yesterday in the Gospel of Matthew that we had to look at a lot of stuff that Matthew pointed us to in the Old Testament to understand what was really fully happening in that narrative of Judas' demise, and the same thing happens here. There are some clues in this story that we're supposed to be looking at the Old Testament. Lots of references to the ancestors and their connections to these places This well is a significant place connected to our ancestor Jacob and so forth. But back in Genesis 24, there's a long, beautifully written story that we don't have time to read like we did John 4. It's a story of Abraham finding a wife for his son Isaac by dispatching his servant back to the land of Abraham and Sarah's people so as to get a wife from among the kinfolk. But he makes the servant promise in the first 9 verses that the servant will find a woman who will come with him back to the new land and won't insist on Isaac going back to live among her people, because Abraham won't bear to be parted from his son. So he dispatches the servant, who goes in verses 10 and following. Along the way he prays that God might please give him a sign of what woman he should speak to, and he asks that when he gets to the territory of the kinfolk and comes to a well, that a woman would appear there and she might be the one. And so he prays. And verse 15, before he had finished speaking, there was Rebekah, born to Bethuel, son of Milcah, wife of Nahor, Abram's brother, coming out with a water jar on her shoulder. The girl was very fair to look upon, a virgin whom no man had known. She went down to the spring, filled her jar, came up. The servant ran to meet her and said, "Please let me sip a little water from your jar." "Drink, my lord," she says. Quickly lowers her jar upon her hand, gives him a drink, and when she's finished giving him a drink, says, "Well, I'll draw for your camels too until they finish." So she draws water for all the camels. The man gazed at her in silence to learn whether or not the Lord had made his journey successful. Then he inquires about who she is, whether or not he can spend the night. She identifies herself and invites him at least to let the camels come and spend the night. And then she runs home, verse 28, and tells her mother's household everything that's happened. The brother Laban runs out there and checks out the stuff that the servant is hauling around with these camels. Finds out he's very rich, invites him to come home with him and spend some time, and he does. And then while he's there in their home, negotiations begin about whether or not we can make a marriage arrangement here. And they decide, yes, indeed, we think we can work this out. Everything hinges upon whether or not Rebekah will go with the servant back away from her family to the new land. And so finally they decide, well, I guess we're going to have to ask her. And in verse 57, they call her and ask her, verse 58, they call her and ask her, "Will you go with this man?" And she said, "I will." And so she goes along and becomes Isaac's wife.
Well, that was something for them to ask her. She wanted to.
That's right. At least they gave her a chance to say no. Does that story sound at all familiar? Person traveling in a foreign area, meeting a woman at a well, having a little conversation, being invited. The woman runs home, tells them what's happened. Man gets invited in. They talk a little bit.
You got arrested now.
Yeah. Yes, okay. Got to watch what you say. The water fountain, yes. Genesis 29, please. Jacob is on a journey away from his home. Among other things, fleeing the wrath of his brother Esau. As he looked, he saw a well in the field and flocks of sheep and a stone covering the opening of the well that had to be moved if you wanted to water sheep. And some shepherds there, and Jacob asks them, where you come from? Finds out they are from his kinfolk. He asks, how are they doing? Well, pretty good, they say. And yes, they say, here is your uncle's daughter, Rachel, coming with the sheep. He said, look, it's still broad daylight. It's not time for the animals to be gathered together. Water the sheep and go pasture them. They said, we can't, till everything, all the flocks are gathered and the stones rolled away. While he was still speaking with them, Rachel came with her father's sheep. When Jacob saw Rachel, the daughter of his mother's brother, and the sheep, Jacob went and rolled the stone away and watered the flock of his mother's brother Laban. And Jacob kissed Rachel and wept aloud. And Jacob told Rachel that he was her father's kinsman and that he was Rebekah's son. And she ran and told her father. When Laban heard about it, he runs out and finds Jacob and says, surely you are bone of my bone and flesh of my flesh. And he stayed with him a month. And then they begin to negotiate whether or not Jacob can have Rachel for wife. And they agree on 7 years of service. And as you all know, eventually he does end up with Rachel, but only after 7 more years because of the old trick of having Leah slipped into his tent on the wedding night the first time around. Same story. Man goes into a foreign land, meets a woman at a well, have a little conversation, girl runs home, tells the family what's happened. They come back out, invite the man in. He comes in, they talk. Eventually he goes home with the woman as wife. Same outline. Exodus chapter 2. Verse 15, Moses is away from home, fleeing, having killed an Egyptian official. Moses fled from Pharaoh. He settled in the land of Midian, sat down by a well. Why are we not surprised? The priest of Midian had 7 daughters. They came to draw water and filled the troughs to water their father's flock, but some shepherds came and drove them away. Moses got up, came to their defense, watered their flock. When they returned to their father Reuel, he said, how is it that you came back so soon today? And they said, well, this Egyptian guy helped us with those nasty shepherds. He even watered for us the flock. He said to his daughters, well, where is he? Why did you leave him there? Invite him to come here and break bread. So Moses agreed to stay with the man. He gave Moses his daughter Zipporah in marriage. She bore him a son. For he said, I've been an alien residing in a foreign land. Same outline. Again. What does this mean? You know, do all the worthies in the history of this people find their wives at wells?
Well, that's a common meeting place in those days.
Yeah. Yes, they're called singles wells. Yeah, in biblical studies, that kind of a story that appears over and over again with variations on a theme is called a type scene. You know, that means it's a typical story. And type scenes communicate a variety of things. The variations on the basic theme are always significant for the life of the character or characters who are the central figures in them. And there are other twists on these kinds of stories that are much more radical than the ones we've seen in the 4 that we've looked at now, including the 3 Old Testament ones and John 4. These variations are significant in the following ways, for example. Notice that of all these stories, the one in which the bridegroom isn't even really present but as a totally passive character is the earliest one, Genesis 24, Isaac isn't even there at his own betrothal. Somebody does it for him. If you remember the whole story of Isaac, Isaac is a totally passive character through the entire history of him that we find in Genesis, beginning with his father hauling him up the mountain to kill him. And he just is passive and says, well, you're going to do it, aren't you? And if you know the rest of his story, he makes no decisions. Rebecca makes all the decisions. And that's the way the story of the betrothal reads. That's the story of Isaac's life. Everything is done to him or for him. He just sort of sits around and gets duped or whatever. And Rebecca is always calling the shots. Who's going to get the blessing? Rebecca stage manages the whole thing. Jacob has to move a lot of rocks, do hard work at his betrothal scene, moving all these stones that have to be moved so that people can be get water at this well. That's the story of Jacob's life, work. He had to work 7 years to get the woman he really wanted, and 7 more years in addition. Moses, notice his betrothal scene is a deliverance scene. And that's the story of Moses' life. He is the deliverer. In fact, what the Hebrew actually says Moses did for the daughters of the priest of Midian the Hebrew verb is yasha, the verb to save. Moses saved the women from those nasty shepherds. So these stories always turn out to be typical of the lives of the central characters. There are other stories that are really different sorts of twists on this that are the same variations on the same theme. Saul, king, the first king of Israel, who had things fall apart on him, he has one of these stories in 1 Samuel 9. He goes to a well and he meets this group of women, and the whole thing falls apart, and he doesn't end up, you know, we have about half of a betrothal scene, and then, you know, he doesn't ever end up getting to the point of being invited in. And so he doesn't get one of them for wife. That's the story of Saul's life. He got part of the way into being king, and then it all came unglued. There's a reverse story exactly like this in the book of Ruth. A woman, a foreign woman, comes to the homeland, and this fellow Boaz speaks to his men and says, when this woman is watering, or when she's in the fields, leave her alone, and so forth, and she's invited in for a meal, and then she gets into the family. So it's a reverse type scene, because it's a reverse situation. So, John 4 is a betrothal story. It has all the components of a betrothal type scene. So this woman is not just a garden variety Samaritan woman who sort of comes out of nowhere and disappears. This is the betrothed of Christ. This is Jesus betrothed. By the end of the story. And John the Baptist told us it was going to be that way. Only I didn't have you read that part. Go back a little ways before John 4 and look at the end of chapter 3, verses 25 and following. There's discussion about who is really the Messiah. And in verse 28 then, John the Baptist says, you yourselves are my witnesses that I said, I am not the Messiah, but I've been sent ahead of him. He who has the bride is the bridegroom. The friend of the bridegroom, the best man who stands and hears him, rejoices greatly at the bridegroom's voice. For this reason, my joy has been fulfilled. So there you have it. John the Baptist says, I'm the best man. The bridegroom is coming. I already hear his voice. And the very next scene is a betrothal scene. So that's who this woman is. Pardon me? Yes. Yes. Yes.
Well, what is the significance of being betrothed to a woman who is so obviously not accepted?
Yeah, well, we'll get to that. We'll have to think about that. Jesus ends up with an unacceptable betrothed. For one thing, she's been around a lot. Been through 5 marriages already. Presently living with somebody. Yeah, we'll try to figure that out. Let's ask first, though, whether we can see in this story features that make it a typical of Jesus' life kind of story, in the same way that it was for Isaac, Jacob, and Moses. Are there any features here you notice that turn out to be indicative of the whole way that things were for Jesus?
He accepts people who are not accepted by the society.
All right, that is sort of the story of his life. The outsiders attaching themselves to him.
He's always talking to people. He's always teaching.
Okay. He, in the middle of his betrothal, he has to do some teaching. Yeah.
He has a direct effect on the people whom he speaks.
Okay. All right, so... You know, lots of things are typical of the way his whole life goes. Did you notice that somehow or another, every one of those Old Testament stories, it was important to know what time it was? Rule wants to know, why are the women back so soon? And the Rachel and those people come at a certain time when it's appropriate to water the sheep. And notice John makes a big deal out of this woman coming at noon. Anything else ever happened significant in Jesus' life at noon? In John, and only in John, it is noon when he is condemned to death and crucified. And back in John 4, he asks for a drink at noon. There is another time in John when he asks for a drink at noontime on the cross. Notice in John 4 he does not get his drink. He asks for a drink and they get to talking and he never gets his drink. The woman ends up with some living water, but he doesn't get his drink. He does not get his drink until he asks for it again at noon from the cross, and then he gets his drink. When he says, I thirst. And what he gets for a drink then is very important. What they run and get him in the Greek is called oxus, a sour wine, a wine vinegar stuff. That soldiers carried with them because they didn't trust the water. Get Hezekiah's revenge from the water. Well, that Greek word is a translation of a Hebrew word, chometz, which means the same thing, cheap, sour wine that you keep available just for drinking when you need it. Not, it's not festival wine, it's just plain old wine that workers and others have around. It so happens that one of the very few places it's mentioned in the Hebrew Bible is in the story when Boaz invites Ruth in for the meal that results in her becoming his betrothed, and she serves, he serves her chometz. So that stuff Jesus drinks has been known to be used in that kind of meal. So that's Jesus' betrothal, finally concluded on the cross. That's where everything in John comes to fulfillment. That's where he becomes the new emperor, the king, on the cross. His cross in John is a throne. And that's where he becomes the perfect Passover lamb, on the cross. And that's why Revelation, the book of Revelation, refers to him in a couple different places as the bridegroom, who is also the lamb, whom we adore as king. And all three of those things he becomes on the cross. The bridegroom, the lamb of God, who takes away the sin of the world, and the king. So, that's what kind of story this is here in John 4. It's a betrothal story, which finally has its fulfillment, like everything else, on the cross. Which does leave us with the question, who is Jesus' bride? Who does this Samaritan woman stand for?
Unacceptable.
Yeah. Gentile folk, unacceptable folk. People who have been around the block a few times.
Yes.
Yeah. The church, right? Yeah. The people of the world who have been around, been through things a bunch. I've read about this woman's marriages in the paper. I know all about this woman. I'm going to read to you the stories of her previous marriages. I collect these things. I save stories about that woman. In my local newspaper in Valparaiso, Indiana, there's a want ad column called the Nifty 50. If you want to sell something for less than $50, you can get a want ad free. And so here's the Nifty 50 column from a few months back. It's always in alphabetical order. So we got pressure sprayer, rocking chair, saucepan, stereo speakers, table lamps, a ticket one way to Orlando, Florida. And then here's the next one. Wedding bands. 10-karat gold, Milagros, his and hers, used 3 months. Like new, $40 for the set, $25 each. And wouldn't you like to know that story? Or maybe we wouldn't. So that marriage of hers was really short. And probably some story connected there. Here's one that lasted a little longer. This is from a few months ago. Headline is, Brothel Date Surprises Husband, Wife. Dateline is Teramo, Italy. A truck driver who went to a brothel expecting a discreet dalliance instead came upon a shocking surprise, his wife. It turned out the woman, a homemaker by day, had been working as a call girl by night, unbeknownst to her husband. The story was recounted Thursday in La Stampa newspaper of Turin. According to the account, a friend gave the 35-year-old truck driver the address of an exclusive bordello in Teramo in central Italy and recommended he ask for a particular woman working there. After a half-hour wait, when he finally obtained the prohibited meeting, the woman he dreamed of and whom he knew only by her working name turned out to be his wife. Housewife by day, high-class call girl by night. The report said the wife tried to run away, but the husband caught her. She filed charges against him after he hit her. That was another one of her marriages. Here's a letter hand-delivered anonymously in 1943 by an Arkansas man to his draft board. So a man came to his draft board and handed this letter to the draft board in 1943. Dear United States Army, my husband asked me to write a recommend that he supports his family. He cannot read, so don't tell him, just take him. He ain't no good to me. He ain't done nothing but raise hell and drink lemon essence since I married him 8 years ago, and I got to feed 7 of his kids. Maybe you can get him to carry a gun. He's good on squirrels and eating. Take him and welcome. I need the grub and his bed for the kids. Don't tell him this, just take him. That one lasted a little longer. Now here's one that lasted a long time. This one's kind of sad. This is from just a couple months ago in Toledo. An 82-year-old man strangled his wife because she wouldn't turn down the volume on the television set, then covered her with an Afghan and went to bed, police said Monday. The couple, who had been married for 40 years, argued before the slaying Saturday night when Mary Visnew, 72, flipped on the television after dinner, Detective Dave Noggle said. Her husband, Leroy Visnew, asked her to turn down the volume. She apparently picked up a shoe and began hitting him, so he put his arm around her neck and held it there for 5 minutes. Visnew covered up his wife, placed a pillow under her head, and went to bed. He's charged with murder and jailed. Neighbor Margaret McPherson said Visnew had a stroke 2 years ago. They've done a lot of arguing all the years they've lived here, she said. It wasn't a happy situation. So that was another one of her marriages. Even some of them that weren't too bad had their quirks. Here's a column from her, one of her husbands to Ann Landers a few months ago. Dear Ann Landers, my wife and I soon will be celebrating our 30th wedding anniversary. And although we've been quite happy together, I can't bring myself to tell my wife something that's been bothering me since our honeymoon. When we unpacked our things in a nice little resort hotel, my wife opened a large suitcase and took out an accordion. Louise had never told me she played the accordion and that she took it with her everywhere. I was flabbergasted that night as I sat through 3 recitals of Lady of Spain and an old English madrigal with some surprisingly ribald lyrics. Those are the only tunes she knows. Our social life has always been rather quiet. Our only close friends are Bernice and Murray. They come over quite often and join Louise in a rousing chorus of Lady of Spain. Murray plays his head. That is, he wraps his knuckles on his head while opening and closing his mouth, which produces changes in tone. Bernice clacks 2 spoons together and hums the harmony. Anne, I've had about all I can take of this. How can I tell my wife after so many years that she is no musician and the racket is driving me crazy? Any suggestion would be greatly appreciated. Signed, Had It on Long Island. Do you want to know what? Dear Long Island, you've been truly wonderful. Please don't blow 30 years of sainthood by losing your temper. Surprise Louise with 12 accordion lessons and several pieces of sheet music. Sorry, but I can't think of a thing you can do about Bernice and Murray. So that's the story of the woman's marriages, and that's our stories too. Some tragedies and some quirks even in the relationships that do last and we call happy ones. And so we are Christ's bride, warts and crimes and sins and all. And so that Samaritan woman, she is us. So, comments, questions? Okay, thank you very much.